Oh, thanks for listening. Thanks for all your calls. Chris and I will be back with 6:06 next Saturday, 7:30 p.m. straight after commentary of Wolves v Liverpool. Next up on 5 Live is a chance to hear Headliners with Nihal Arthanayake. 6:06 is a Shooting Sharp production for BBC Radio 5 Live. What a show, Christopher. What a show. Have a good week. Good night.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
With the BBC News on 5 Live at 8 o'clock, I'm Richard Foster. The issue of private donations has clouded the first day of the Labour Party conference in Liverpool. The Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, says she understands why some people are angry, but insists the government followed the rules and has been transparent. Baroness Hodge, who was a Labour MP for nearly 30 years, says the issue is a distraction.
I know Keir well, and I think he will be as devastated as everybody else that this went wrong. But they've stopped it. And I think this is the moment that we bring forward really, really clear, strong proposals to clean up politics, to set the rules, to ensure they're properly enforced and to ensure proper accountability to the public.
The US says it warned Israel that a conflict with Lebanon is not in its best interests. Attacks between the Hezbollah group and the Israeli military have intensified. The United Nations, Britain and Egypt have also called for restraint. The White House national security spokesman is John Kirby.
The tensions are much higher now than they were even just a few days ago. We certainly have been monitoring the reports of strikes back and forth across that border. But all that does is underscore for us how important it is to try to find a diplomatic solution. Nobody's Pollyannish about how hard that's going to be, certainly in light of the events over the last week or so. But that doesn't mean we're going to give up on it.
Germany's chancellor appears to have narrowly dodged humiliation after exit polls suggested his party held off the far right in his home state. Olaf Scholz's centre-left Social Democratic Party won Sunday's regional election in Brandenburg by just 1 or 2 percentage points. People with asthma or severe acne are no longer going to be banned from joining Britain's armed forces. The Defence Secretary John Healey says he wants to end what he sees as outdated entry requirements to tackle a recruitment crisis. And it also announced plans to get computer gamers to join a new cyber defence effort. Further heavy rains forecast for parts of the UK following intense thunderstorms. The Met Office has issued an amber warning across central and southern England during the early hours of tomorrow. It'll bring the risk of flooding and further travel disruption. And the Princess of Wales has been spotted in public for the first time since finishing her cancer treatment. Catherine was seen at a church in Aberdeenshire earlier. She announced she'd return to public duties after completing chemotherapy. That's the news. Andy Barwell has the sport.
John Stones scored Manchester City's equaliser deep into added time in a 2-2 draw at home to Arsenal. The day's other Premier League fixture, Brighton against Nottingham Forest, also ended 2-2. Celtic scored 4 times in the last 20 minutes as they beat Falkirk 5-2 in the last of the Scottish League Cup quarterfinals. And interestingly, today's Women's Super League action included a 2-2 draw between Arsenal and Manchester City. McLaren's Lando Norris was the winner of the Singapore Grand Prix, and the American Billy Horschel took a playoff to win the European Tour's PGA Championship at Wentworth.
On Radio 4, the more you listen, the more you see.
We're living under more tyranny today than our founding fathers did in 1775.
A US presidential election is looming, but underneath, conspiracy culture rears its head once again. And nothing is as it seems.
All those things that we had feared our whole lives was coming true.
Burn the house down and start over. That seems to be the way.
It's America through the looking glass. Join me, Gabriel Gatehouse, as The Coming Storm continues. Listen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Headliners with Nihal Arthanayake.
Welcome to Headliners. Now, this is week 2 of the Headliners' greatest conversations in the world that you will ever hear with me, Nihal Arthanayake. Now, if you missed any of the show or just want to listen again, I won't blame you, of course, for wanting to listen to it forever. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast. You'll also find extra content not heard on the radio show. It's available straight after today's show. Just search for Headliners Podcast on BBC Sounds. And everyone's beggy about subscribing these days. But when I say subscribe, I mean it will enrich your life, other than others who say subscribe, and they are wasting your time. Minutes you'll never get back. So there you go. Subscribe to Headliners. And when you see me, high five me and say, yay, Nihal, you were right. Now, today's show features another 2 extraordinary guests. And one of them is on the show because a few months back, A mate of mine was handling the VIP guest list for a big fight in LA where Eminem was performing, right? And I messaged my mate and said, listen, my pal Jimmy Akinbola is in LA. Why don't you invite him? So that happened. Jimmy got treated beautifully, got to see Eminem in close quarters, was sitting there amongst loads of important VIPs in Los Angeles where he lives now. And not only that, but this was on the cusp of season 3 of Bel-Air dropping in America. Huge series, exec produced by Will Smith, a kind of reimagining of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, but completely different. Quite a dark drama. And Jimmy plays Jeffrey, not the Jeffrey that you will remember from The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. This guy is a North London or East London dude. He fixes things. Think about Mr. Wolf from Pulp Fiction. He's that kind of dude. He just, you know, makes things happen. Anyway, Jimmy Akinbola was then in Manchester doing some promo around an ITV show he does called The Tower. And he messaged me and said, I'm in town. You got time to meet? I was like, yeah. And my daughter was still on her summer holidays. So her and I went and had breakfast with Jimmy Akinbola. And while we were sitting there, he said, I'm in the country till, you know, the 12th of September. I went, okay, well, let's interview you then. And that's how it happened. He's a fascinating guy. He really is. And he's had an interesting journey. And just imagine this guy, you know, this guy from London, brought up in care. And then suddenly he's at Hollywood A-listers house. He can get a table at the best restaurants in Los Angeles and New York. People know he is. Anyway, instead of me telling you all about it, why don't you just listen to him? Added to Jimmy Akinbola, we also have the force of nature, the just inspirational author Candice Brathwaite. Runs ultra marathons, writes incredible books that appeal to so many people. My wife follows Candice Brathwaite on social media. 300,000 plus followers on Instagram. Both brilliant, brilliant people. You may not be aware of their work, but you will be entranced by these two individuals. Now, imagine a klaxon, an alarm going off. That is the "this is not live" klaxon, which means you don't have to text in. And if you do, no one will read it. But what you could do is go on my socials and I'm listening along with you. So here we go. Jimmy Akinbola, followed by Candice Brathwaite.
Headliners with Nihal Arthur-Nayaka.
Yes, Jimmy.
Hey, how you doing, mate? You all right?
Sorry to keep you waiting, Jesus.
It's all right.
You can't keep the star waiting. That's
ridiculous. Yeah, I was going to flip a table and have a tantrum and everything.
Should have done that. Life is good.
Good.
Right?
Yeah,
you
I felt like you were saying that for yourself.
No, not
I
for
think
you.
Life is good for you too.
it is because I'm hanging out with you. But I mean, how often are you reminded in the position you currently are when it wasn't good? How often is that a constant reminder?
It's interesting. Like, I was born in Plaistow, East London, and I still go to the same barbers, Mr. T's on the Barking Road. And when I walk down that Barking Road, I remember the 16 to sort of 19, 20-year-old version of myself, you know, being an usher at Theatre Royal Stratford East, not having that much money, looking at other friends that have got normal 9-to-5 jobs, driving their cars, do you know what I mean? Like wearing the nice fits. And then me being tested going like, I wasn't struggling. I had a council flat. But I was also looking at them going, I felt like they were moving on with life in a better way than me. You know, that they, in some ways, I thought life was good for them. And I found it hard in those early days for me of like working hard and struggling at times to get to where I suppose I am now. And so I suppose depending where I am, those feelings, those memories of like, I remember when it was really tough, really hard, or when I've spent like a year not working. And I relish those moments, Nihal, because it keeps me grounded, reminds me how far I've come. And also I realize no matter where you are in your life, there's always that next level, Nihal, of like you don't just do the work and get to a point and go, oh, I can kick back. You can embrace the moment, which I do and I am. But then the next thing is like, well, what's next? What is next after this great job or this great moment? And I still have aspirations and dreams to do other things. And so that requires me to step into a new chapter each time. And alongside that, there's lots of disappointments. You know, some people just see Jeffrey at Bel Air right now and go, oh, he's just got there. And it's like, no, there's been years of me being on stage, you know, years of me being unemployed. You have personal stuff, family losses. Life can be looking good, and especially now we have social media, you know. We are all dealing with real life things behind the lens of life or social media or celebrity, if you want to use that term. And I think the last 5, 6, 7 years have been really, really tough in terms of juggling those things. And especially when you are, you know, America don't know, I've done a lot of comedy here. So it's also you're tapping into your happy, hey, the fun child, and you're trying to do that when you're playing your character. But also, I'm naturally that when I come on set. And then what's difficult is that sometimes, I think comedians are like this. Sometimes when you meet them off, they don't want to be doing the jokes. They just want to be chill. Some love to take center stage, but there's a lot. They're just like, nah, I'm not on. And they're the opposite. And I found that, you know, I couldn't allow myself to be the opposite. I was still trying to be, hey, I'm Jimmy, the fun guy. You know, while we're hanging out, I can turn up while we're shooting. And actually, I'm actually struggling also on the other side of like, my brother's fighting for his life, or I've lost 4 family members in the space of 15, 16 months. You know what I mean? I'm grieving. You know what I mean? But how do I allow myself space for that? Because back to your question, things are all good to people looking up to me or looking towards me. But actually, I can't afford to stop. You know what I mean? Because I've got to another level, but it doesn't stop. I've got to keep going. Otherwise, it's a snake and ladder syndrome that, you know, I feel like things might stop. The career might stop. So it's like, how do you give yourself space to grieve or take a minute, take a beat and look after yourself? When there's that, I think maybe it's that working class, like, keep working, don't stop working, you know what I mean? Because you never know when it's going to end. And I think constantly, I think a lot of creatives battle with that sort of work and life balance, you know? There's trying to balance your relationships with work. So it's a lot. I don't want to sort of like, I don't know, sort of poo-poo like what I've done or where I am. But like, I feel like if we can have a real conversation, I can't just tell you, yeah, it's all great. It's never been hard. It's like, no, I've worked very hard for where I am and I'm still going. And this is a great moment, but it's not the end point.
What about primary school, Jimmy Akinbola then? What about when you think about that kid? Because you talked about the teenage years, but what about the primary school years?
Primary school years. That's a good one. Primary school years, I think I was just a normal kid having a lot of fun. And so primary school, I would say like 5 to like 7 or whatever. And then you go like, you know, junior school up to 11. So those years for me were about me, I think, wrestling with my place in the world, identity. There was a lot of fighting. There was a lot of sort of being an 80s kid. There was a lot of like racism going on. I think I wanted to also be loved. I think that's about like me being fostered as a young kid. And I think that leads also into like sort of, I want to say, mini identity crisis and stuff like that. And I think my primary junior school years were also about, I used to daydream a lot. But it wasn't about being an actor. I think it was just enjoying being able to remove myself from the world that I was in. And it wasn't that it was terrible, but I just like to let myself go to places. And then I think also when I think about those times, I remember seeing the families and the kids that were part of families that were doing really, 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 really well. I don't think I understood it, but I would look at it maybe as what kind of bikes they had, toys, clothes. And like, we did great. Like, as a working class family, there was 4 of us. you know, but I was always aware of that sort of that next level. And I think over years, as I grew up, going to secondary school, I realized for me to have that life, it comes from doing a job that I can do really well and excelling. But I didn't know what that was until I was like 16.
When you meet someone, Jimmy, who's been also fostered, what are the kind of conversations? What is the bond that you have with someone when you discover that they've had that experience that you've had?
When I go back to, I think, between 16 and 19, if I met somebody that's been in the care system, adopted or fostered, straight away I'd be like, wow, wasn't it amazing, right? It was great, yeah? And they look at me like, what? Nah, Jim, it was terrible for me. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I almost couldn't allow them to tell me their experience because it was such an opposite to my positive, loving experience. And I still definitely, I think the joy suffocated some of the trauma that I had to go through as a young kid. Do you know what I mean? You know, if it was a percentage, I would say 80% joy, 20% trauma. And I think when I would see other people sharing me their stories and their horrific, it was hard to hear. I felt like there was an immediate bond, but also I think I couldn't, I found it hard to understand why their experience was the opposite to mine. And as young kids that have been through the same thing, I think straight away we immediately connected to the struggle of wanting to belong. You know, I think I can talk about it now, but I realized we had in some ways conversations about abandonment. You know, those friends of mine and people that I met that were adopted or fostered by a black family, there were some things that they couldn't understand when I would talk about my experience being brought up with a white foster family, you know? So it was really interesting where you're on the same page with certain stuff and then suddenly I'm on my own lane, you know, unless I meet someone that's going through something similar. When I would meet someone that's going through something similar in terms of might have a white foster family, we talk about that thing of like, when you go to school, you got parents there and then people are asking you, how comes your parents are white? and I remember this other guy we just talked about, you would just roll it out. Like, it's just general knowledge. It goes, oh, because I'm fostered. And they're like, oh, you're adopted. No, adoption is this. And I'd be able to tell you now, like, exactly what adoption is. I'm saying, no, I'm fostered. And it'd be pride as well, because fostering is different, because with fostering, my mum's still around, even though she wasn't always around because she was battling with mental health, illness and stuff like that. But I still have a family. And I think that came from my foster family of like explaining why I'm fostered and not adopted and them allowing my Nigerian biological family to constantly be in and out of my life growing up as a kid. And I think that helped me eventually settle down and embrace my identity. Do you know what I mean? In terms of this British born Nigerian that is a mismatch of a Nigerian family and a white British family, you know? And that all those things, now I suppose this came out in my documentary, Handle With Care, all those things, as I hit my 20s, I realized are the blessings, and there's some things that I found really hard to deal with, but they've made me the man I am today in a positive way. It leans into the acting. It leans into the guy that has a complete diverse range of friends as well, you know, because that blended family connection's been with me since a two-year-old. I can see it through color. I can see it through class. It doesn't matter, you know. And I think all of those things have bled into my work, my friendships. We all have things that we're getting over and trauma. Everyone has some bit of that if they really want to be honest with themselves. And I think it took me a while to be honest with myself about my beginning and how traumatic that is, which that is about, yeah, abandonment and, you know, wanting to be loved. You know, I was loved by my foster family, but, you know, the family, the woman that birthed me, how do you deal with that as you move on in your years? You know, I mean, how does that pop up even when you're not aware of it? And then how do you handle it once you go, oh, okay. That makes some sense now in terms of when I look back on life and how I've handled things, even like dealing with that stuff alongside the highs. You know what I mean? And when I say the highs, you know, how I remember I was doing In the Long Run with Idris Elba. It's a comedy on Sky. One of my favorite jobs playing his, we played brothers. He played his dad. I played his dad's brother. It felt like a Coming to America, you know, vibe type of TV show. But I remember I was doing that show, season three, and it was a highlight for me, you know, and I'm back in the UK working with my idol, a hero. But also I'm battling with the fact that my brother, Shegun Akinbolo, is battling with cancer. He's fighting for his life. And now, like, there's this young kid in me that's found a way to overcome tough moments. But I remember that was the one time I couldn't do it, man. Like, I couldn't do what I've done before when my dad's rejected me or when my mom's, you know, may have got sectioned or like I couldn't do this thing that's got me through traumatic things in life. And so it was almost like I hit this steel wall that was like, you need to go and do some therapy, mate. You know what I mean? And then what I felt like is that the high that my work gave me also wasn't enough. And it was hard, you know, it was hard. And then since then, there's been many moments of like that where it's just about being real with life, right? It's like, yes, it all looks good and shiny, but I think this goes back to your first question. It's like, just because I'm doing some great jobs, like sometimes life can be looking good, and especially now we have social media, you know, my reminder to myself is that Instagram is not real, but like we are all dealing with real life things behind the lens of life.
I mean, you live in LA. LA is a place that can be incredibly busy, party town, or incredibly isolating and lonely because it's so spread out. Because of what you've just described that has happened to you personally over the last 16 months, Jimmy, have you allowed yourself? I mean, look, you're still in the midst of this, right? Like the idea that you've processed everything that's happened to you in the last 16 months in family terms, you know, it'd be absurd to think that you had. So are you using work to make sure you don't have to confront it?
No, good question. No, I hear you. I like timelines. Actually, I talk about all those things, losing four members over 16 months. That wasn't 16 months ago, if I'm honest.
Okay,
that was
right.
Between 2019 through to, you know, the end of the pandemic, you know?
Wow. Okay. So that's a dark time anyway with the pandemic around.
There you go. So right, sorry, okay. I'm talking in terms of hindsight, but that's okay. What I was going through and doing those jobs. So I think I didn't in that time, to answer your question, I didn't. But then I think it gets to a point where you have to. There wasn't much work going, and I couldn't work. Like my body, I couldn't function. So I like hit that wall where I was like, I need to take that time. And I ended up like going to Barbados for a bit and with a couple of friends of mine, you know, I'm sure she won't mind me saying, like Chizzy Akadulu, very actress, comedian, very good friend of mine. And she had gone through some loss as well. And so we were just took ourselves away to grieve together. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, really say no to the agent, no audition. Like just, I need to stop. And so eventually I was forced to do that. And yet, I speak to people, it's been 20 years since they lost people. And they're like, Jimmy, it feels like yesterday every day, you know? And so I don't know how much time is needed to take out, for you to take time out and get over something like that, especially when you've had four people. Like each cycle, I never got a chance to get over one person because somebody else passed, you know? And so I think it's been a slow, gradual thing. And I think I'm still dealing with it on and off now. I think it comes in waves. I'm a person that I try to realize it's not just me. You know, my brother, Shegun, who passed, he left a young boy, you know, a young teenager behind. You know what I mean? So there is that thing of like, there's my loss and grief, but then I'm like, how does a young kid, you know, sort of deal with that?
Because we find out, don't we, when we get older, just how influential our childhoods are on our adult life, you know, because we spend, you know, our 20s and stuff moving forward, 30s maybe, and then you get into kind of close to middle age and then suddenly you start to think about, oh, actually, this is the way I behave. I can trace it back to this. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about words like abandonment and trauma in childhood, then how does that manifest itself as a as a man?
You know, I think...
does it help with acting in the sense that... Does it help with resilience? Because you've had to be resilient from a young age, right?
Yeah.
Without even knowing you're being resilient.
There you go.
And acting is an industry which is full of rejection. But you've already had the worst rejection that anyone can really have. There's no not getting a part that is worse than being fostered.
Yeah.
Even though your experience of being fostered was a good one.
Yeah. Ah, Nihal, you're going in, mate. I'm going in.
Yeah, man.
But no, I love it. What's the book, Nihal? I can't remember. There's that Oprah book. She talks to the doctor. She talks about kids that can have a relatively calm upbringing that they find it much harder when they're older, when they come up against situations that we're talking about right now, right? Because they don't have the chance to develop those muscles, right?
Yeah. So what happened to you? That's the name of the book.
There
Conversations on Trauma, Resilience and Healing.
If you've been through stuff, it's such a good read because it talks about some young people that go through stuff, the resilience that you develop as a young kid. There is a way to use that resilience and it be empowering. So that level of resilience, you said it, the biggest rejection is me being abandoned. And then when I get into acting or I'm trying to play football, like the resilience to keep going, you get no's and losing out on a job could be on the level of like, you've just been abandoned again. It might sound a bit OTT, but like, I've cried when I've not got work. Do you know what I mean? You know, I'm like, I've really constantly had to get myself back on the horse. But like the resilience to keep going where you could have a year, 2 years, 8 years of no. That's why I do say the positive impact of my upbringing. And I include all of it. I'm not just talking about the loving, the great stuff. I'm talking about the traumatic stuff I had to overcome. So when I pitched my documentary Handle With Care, it was about during the pandemic. So you got, you know, Black Lives Matter, the Black Squares, and you got so much going on. I was like, I want to do a story that my 13-year-old self could watch and be inspired to be anything he wants to be. I'm not talking about fame. I'm talking about teacher, doctor, lawyer, whatever, you know, a delivery driver. It doesn't matter. But I felt like society, and I think also within TV and film, it was mining trauma, you know, in terms of like, it was so easy to focus on the stats that say majority of people that have been through care, they end up, you know, maybe homeless, drugs, you know, incarceration, jail, won't have a relationship, healthy relationship, won't have a family. I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. They might be the stats, but they're not everybody's story. And if you keep just rolling out these things in TV, film, in the newspapers, then even not just these 13-year-old kids, these kids in care, even the adult versions of themselves, how do they really like let go of that and allow themselves to excel and be the beautiful human beings that they are? You're not helping. It's almost like if I would tell people now that I've been fostered straight away, they'd be like, oh, bless you. It must have been terrible. I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. I've just told you I was fostered. You don't even know my story yet. But I get it. I'm not angry at them. It's like a default to what they're used to seeing. It's almost like growing up in the 80s. Oh, you're from Africa. Oh, the flies. I see all the commercials. Like, yo, yes, there's some poverty in Africa. There's poverty in all countries. But the wealth in Africa, where are the houses? Do you know what I mean? Where are the mansions? Where are the people with the Mercedes bit? Like, give me the balanced view. And so it was really important to me to, it was tricky, within an hour to give the nuances to adoption and foster care, not just to the young kids and the adults that have been through care, but also the people that have cared for them. So like the parents that may have to give up their child, you know, or the parents that are deciding to take on somebody else's child, you know, and then within that, the complexities of my biological siblings, me not growing up with them until I was in my teens, and then my foster siblings, how I impacted my foster siblings' life. There's so many different nuances to this world of adoption and fostering. And what was lovely, Nihal, is that I got a lot of DMs and messages from people saying, thank you for the story. But it was from people that are fostering or have adopted, as well as people that have been through it. And I wanted to do that in a way that it wasn't 90% negative. You know, Chris Akabusi says, Jimmy, your story is amazing compared to mine, because he said for him, like, going through all the different families was hell. His safe haven was a children's home. And I'm going, whoa, I feel like you ask most kids, they don't want to be stuck in a children's home. They want to be loved. They want to be with a family. You know what I mean? And it was so interesting that we had these different viewpoints, but they both weren't wrong. They both were right. You know what I mean? There's space for both of them. And ironically, I'm talking to someone like Chris, gold, silver medalist. You know what I mean? He's someone, he's my hero. And he still finds it hard to see himself like that.
Jimmy, I'm loving this conversation. Let's just take a break now for some news and sport, and we'll come back, carry on this conversation afterwards.
Headliners with Nihal Arthur-Nayaka.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
And with the headlines, I'm Richard Foster. The issue of private donations has clouded the first day of the Labour conference in Liverpool. The Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, says she understands why some people are angry, but insists the government followed the rules and has been transparent. President Biden says the US will do all it can to prevent a wider war in the Middle East. The UN says the latest attacks between Israel and Hezbollah have brought the Middle East to the brink of an imminent catastrophe. The Justice Secretary says she's furious that some prisoners have been released early without ankle tags. Shabana Mahmood has been demanding answers from the prison's contractor Serco and says the company could face penalties. And Liam Gallagher says imposters aren't welcome at the Oasis reunion concerts next year. It's after he was criticised for a performance before the fight between Anthony Joshua and Daniel Dubois. Reviews were mixed, but he says people just didn't appreciate his angelic tones. That's the news. Andy Barwell has the sport.
Well, a true heavyweight clash between two Premier League title rivals. It ended Manchester City 2, Arsenal 2. Erling Haaland had opened the scoring with his 100th goal for City. Arsenal had hit back through Ricardo Calafiori and Gabriel, although Leandro Trossard was sent off in first-half stoppage time. Some resolute defending looked like claiming Arsenal the win, only for John Stones to get the Manchester City equaliser there in the 98th minute of the game. Well, Mikel Arteta says his Arsenal side showed great courage to keep City at bay for so long with just 10 players.
We did a lot of things good, but it's very difficult. It's an accident waiting to happen. You play the best team in the world for 56 minutes with 10 men, which doesn't allow you to put any pressure on the ball, doesn't allow you to get out from your own box, and they don't lose the ball. So they lose it inside the six-yard box, which means that there's no option either to run. So very complicated, but again, for these players to be that humble and that disciplined and show that competitiveness is just incredible.
Brighton and Nottingham Forest drew 2 apiece at the Amex. Both managers were red carded late on in the game, along with the Forest player Morgan Gibbs-White. In the Championship today, Preston North End forward Milutin Osmaic could face a lengthy ban after appearing to bite an opponent during their goalless Lancashire derby match against Blackburn Rovers. Celtic were 5-2 winners over Falkirk in the last of the Scottish League Cup quarterfinals. In the draw for the semi-finals, Celtic will take on Aberdeen. Motherwell will play the holders Rangers. In today's Women's Super League action, Vivian Miedema scored a goal and made another on her return to the Emirates Stadium as Manchester City drew 2-2 with the former club Arsenal. Liverpool and Leicester drew 1 apiece, and Tottenham, they defeated newly promoted Crystal Palace 4-0, and Celtic beat the Ukrainian side Volska Poltava 1-0 in the first leg of their Women's Champions League qualifier. Elsewhere in sport today, Lando Norris in the McLaren was a comfortable winner of the Singapore Grand Prix. That victory takes Norris to 52 points off the championship leader Max Verstappen. There are 6 races to go. Verstappen, though, is remaining calm for the run-in to the end of the season.
Yeah, it is, but this also can change very quickly again, so we just need to keep on trying, keep to... Of course, at one point tried to overturn it a bit, you know, not always finishing behind, but we'll see how that goes.
In golf, a 3-way playoff for the European Tour's PGA Championship at Wentworth, Rory McIlroy, South Africa's Tristan Lawrence and the American Billy Horschel all finished there on 20 under par, and it was Horschel who came out on top at the second extra hole to win the title for a second time.
Listen, my heart was pounding on, you know, the last couple shots, the last couple holes, and especially in the playoff, but... It's always fun being in those situations. That's what we work so hard for. That's what I've worked so hard for. That's what I've always wanted to be in situations like that, trying to win tournaments, going against the best players in the world, and hopefully being able to come out on top. And in the day, I was able to nip Rory and Tristan, and and come away with a victory.
And cricket's 50-over one-day cup final between Somerset and Glamorgan is to go into reserve day at Trent Bridge after a washout today.
Welcome to the Tooney and Russo show on BBC Sounds. I am here with two of football's most famous friends, Alessia Russo and Ella Toon.
Remember when you scored and you did like five different celebrations?
Yeah. I did all sorts. Hands went up, hands went out, a jump. So awkward.
Someone's given them to a podcast. Are you joking?
It was like the best 3 years ever. I think I came back a bit Americanized.
Yeah, she did.
She started saying these mad words. Soccer. They'd like have this like American accent. They've been there a month.
The Tooney and Russo show with me, Vic Hunt. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Headliners. With Nihal Athanayake.
When I go back to, I think, between 16 and 19, if I met somebody that's been in the care system, adopted or fostered, straight away I'd be like, wow, wasn't it amazing, right? It was great, yeah? And they look at me like, what? It was terrible for me. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I almost couldn't allow them to tell me their experience because it was such an opposite to my positive, loving experience. The joy suffocated some of the trauma that I had to go through as a young kid. Do you know what I mean? When I would see other people sharing me their stories and they're horrific, it was hard to hear. I felt like there was immediate bond, but also I found it hard to understand why their experience was the opposite to mine.
Welcome back to Headliners, the only place where you can hear platinum-plated conversations, not just on a Sunday night, but all the time. Still to come, my conversation with author and journalist Candice Brathwaite. But first, let's get back to the interview stroke conversation with the actor Jimmy Akinbola.
The biggest names. Headliners with Nihal Athanayake.
Jimmy, welcome back. Thank you for your patience.
No, thank you for having me.
No, man, come on, always. Right, let's carry on. The Tower and ITV, Bel Air in the US. Like we said, going back to our first conversation, life is good professionally. Bel Air's put you in some extraordinary rooms, Jimmy, with some extraordinary people.
Yeah.
What is, in your impression, Will Smith really like? What is the thing that you see in Will Smith that most people will never get a chance to see because they not meet him and they'll never get to spend any time with him?
That's a real good question. He's such a big personality, and I think we've all known him for many, many years. You know what? I think he's consistent. I think there can be a perception that he just puts it on, right? It's Will, the nice guy, says all these things. And yet, even through his toughest moments, I felt like he still remained consistent. When I recently saw him, he was just very open about what he'd been through. You know what I mean? He was the elephant in the room. And he would talk about it to these young, us next generation of like, balance of work and life, like what we're talking about now, and about what it can feel like when things are really good and busy, you're going up, but when it starts feeling like you're going upstream against the tide, then maybe it's time to create a boundary and say no and take a beat. You know what I mean? And it was just like, it was so beautiful because you've got a cast that's looking up to you, and you could just, he could have just put on this thing of like, yeah, I'm Will Smith. Do you know what I mean? Nothing touched me. I feel like it was a moment of vulnerability, humility, and giving real advice to all of us going on our separate journeys that are entering into a new phase and just giving us some of the secrets to what possibly could help us handle our individual successes, if that makes sense. And I think that is him being consistent, you know, even in an intimate setting. And I think even within that, he's just naturally inspiring. He came to set this year and he was like, loving what you guys are doing. I feel like this season's the best out of the three. And he's like, this is a moment. This is a moment for all of you. Like, whatever you're thinking about doing, do it, you know? And it was really nice that to get that from him. And then he talked about the time where he was in the middle of doing a Fresh Prince and he had his, I think it was Summertime track coming out. And I don't know if you remember this, there was a moment where the Summertime track ended up in the episode. And I'm going, wow. Like, not many people doing that now. You had your own music in your own TV show. And then that Summertime tune, like, was a massive hit. But the rollout, do you know what I mean? Like, the rollout of aligning your music with your TV show. And then he starts talking about, we asked him, he's like, how do you rest? How did you rest? He's like, I never rested. I took maybe 10 days out over the year, over Christmas. And then I was in the studio with Jazz doing the album. Then I was doing a movie in the summer. Then I was going back to Bel Air. And we all sat there like, that's another level. But then he hasn't stopped. Yeah, if you look, it hasn't stopped. Bel Air is probably the most successful TV show on Peacock. That's from him backing this young guy, Morgan Cooper, who created the idea from Kansas. He's, you know, Bad Boys 4 has done the box office. You know, he's got his book out, you know, and now he's about to drop an album. So it's like, and off the back of, you know, a difficult period of life, like we've just been talking about, of like the yin and yang of like, yeah, it's all good. But
does he talk specifically about the Chris Rock thing? Does he? And I obviously I would never ask you to say what he says to you guys in private, because that's private. But does he talk about that specifically or just talk about it in general terms?
I suppose it's like we've had moments of like in general terms. That's what I would say to that. Right. Jeremy. It's never been specific. But even that, I think, is he doesn't have to. And I think that's, for me, that aligns with the consistency of like, well, I still need to be open, honest, transparent with you and vulnerable, like, you know, and through these kinds of conversations, that would be his way of talking about it.
Yeah. Cause I mean, he must be super conscious of the fact that when he walks in a room, people must be so nervous to meet him. How does he put you at ease? And have you seen him do it? I mean, not just to you, but kind of spectating and like, okay, this is Will Smith. Will Smith, anyone that meets Will Smith is going to be, who's not super famous already, mm-hmm. is going to be going in their heads, oh my gosh, that is Will Smith.
Yep. You know what I think he does? He really does take you in and like is 100% giving you his time. And then I think off the back of that, he works hard to ground the situation, i.e., I'm another human being. I am interested to what you've got to say. I appreciate your flowers that you're giving me, but what are you doing? And actually, within that, let me have a proper life conversation. You know what I mean? Like, with maybe something I'm struggling with as an artist. And there's a bit of you, you're listening, you're like, you have to catch up and realize that, no, I am just having, like, when we bumped into each other in Manchester, the way that we could just lock in a normal conversation is like, oh, wait, I'm having that with Will. But I think he's conscious of that. Otherwise, all the conversations can be stay up there and people aren't grounded because they're like, oh, I'm talking to Will. And he just brings it straight down. And he does that also even with contemporaries. Do you know what I mean? Like, there was a moment at a premiere for Bel Air season 3, he was there all day with us doing press. We were there from the morning to early evening doing press, and he was on the front line with us. And Big Sean came over, and so I'm not grounded. I'm like, it's Big Sean. I want to get a picture. Like, yo, it's Big Sean. And I'm trying to be chill. But just even the way that Big Sean was the same, I was just like, these are two big artists just connecting, but showing like, they're human beings and they're just having a grounded conversation about tipping point of creativity. Basically, you know, cooking up the new album in the studio. Like, what does it look like when you hit the wall? And you know what I mean? And I'm just like, what? Wait, you're saying that you struggle? And like, you're saying, yeah, Big Sean, you've taken time out because you needed to just, you know, reset and come with something fresh. And it's just like, oh my God, this is brilliant. And then suddenly you've got the Adrian Holmes who play Uncle Phil. And then suddenly we're all talking about art, then we start talking about things going through life, and then we're talking about being grateful for our health because, you know, everybody's just going through certain things and may have lost people. And it's just like a real beautiful, normal conversation. But I think it's led by Will going, look, I'm aware of how people operate and can react to me. So let me do as much as I can to ground the conversation, make you feel at ease, but also let me lead with I think vulnerability and transparency and just, you know, genuinely being interested to what you want to talk about and what, you know, what you've got going on in your life.
Now, tell me about going to Jamie Foxx's place, Jimmy, right? And did you go in a stretch Hummer? Did you go in a Lambo? Did you go in a helicopter? What was your vehicle of choice to turn up to Jamie Foxx's mansion, Jimmy Akinbola?
I can't believe you're asking me this. All right. So people, he's a bad man. Basically, this is the story. It's one of my few LA stories. I'm in LA. I'm at Nobu in Malibu. And I'm having dinner with her.
I mean, that is about as bougie a sentence as you can possibly say. Let's be real. I was at Nobu in Malibu, right?
All right.
The man from East London was not saying that 20 years ago.
No, I'll be saying I'm at the Southern Fried Chicken Shop on the Market Road. All right, let me give you the full story, actually.
Okay.
My friend Denise Baharkinson, she's calling me going, Jimmy, we're trying to get into Nobu. I'm like, okay. She's like, I'm going to use your name. I'm like, listen, I'm just Jimmy Akinbola from East London. They're not going to do anything. You know what I mean? And then she gets back to me. She goes, Jimmy, I've got a table. As soon as I said your name, Dave's like, yep, cool. But Jimmy, we can't give you the table until Jimmy turns up. So I'm like, what? That's amazing. So I drive to Nobu, and I don't drive in LA. I can drive, but I normally Uber. But a friend gave me his Prius. So I drive in my Prius to Nobu. And actually, it's the first time I've been to Nobu. I knew where it was, but it's the first time I've been.
Right. And this is the most bougie Japanese restaurant, right? There's one in Mayfair. There's
gorgeous. And I'm like, I'm going to Nobu. I'm just not even thinking I'm going to Nobu. You know, I'm looking.
Have the black cod.
Yes, you know it. So I'm like, I can't wait. I've been told it's on the beach. So I get there and I'm like, oh no. I get there and it's like all Lambos, Porsches, you know, Ranges. And I turn up with my friend's silver Prius. But I'm like, I don't care. I'm Jim McEnroe from East London. I'm keeping it real. I want to eat at this Nobu. So I park the car myself. I don't do valet. I'm like, it's cool. I don't need valet. And then I'm like, I can't find parking. So I have to do valet. I give it to the guy. I walk in and then security are like, yo, what's up, man? Love what you do. And he's dabbing me up going, I love Jeffrey. I'm like, oh, great. All right, cool. And then I sit down and then we're having sushi. And then basically Jeff Daniels walks past and we all say hello to Jeff Daniels. There's a couple of other stars. I can't remember their names behind us. I'm like, this is amazing. And then I get a text from Daniel Kaluuya saying, Jimmy, what you on tonight? It's my birthday. Come through. So I'm like, okay, cool, Dan. Great to hear from you. Definitely, I'll be there. Telling my table, look, guys, I'm going to have to leave soon because I've got to go to Dan Kaluuya's birthday. They're like, no problem. And then I come out and there's photographers taking pictures of everybody coming out. And then I'm like, oh my God, I've got to get in this Prius. So I'm just like, ah, Jimmy, stop it. It's all good. Just get in the Prius and go. Get in the Prius and go. Go to Daniel Kaluuya's party. Everybody's there. Donald Glover, Damson Idris, Cynthia Erivo, like Lena Waithe, like everybody, Black Hollywood's there. And then it's wrapping up and everyone's like, yeah, we're going to Jamie's house. And I'm like, what? Jamie who? Who's Jamie? They're like, Jamie Foxx. And then we go to Jamie Foxx's house. I'm in the Prius and I get to Jamie Foxx's gated mansion and I'm going up this hill. My Prius is screaming because it's a steep hill. And I'm the only one in a Prius, by the way. There's some amazing cars there. And I sheepishly asked the guy where I put my car. He's like, put it there. And I'm in between, you know, Ferraris, all the cars. I'm like, this is ridiculous. And I get into Jamie Foxx's like studio where he talks about where he worked with Kanye. And it's a massive party. Like everyone's there. And then he starts talking about that moment when he did the track with Kanye. And he, as he's telling us the story, he winks to his DJ friend and then they press play. And he's like, she wants some Marvin Gaye, some Luther Vandross. And then we all start singing and dancing. And I'm in that moment, I'm like, this is crazy. This young kid from Plaistow, from Newham, one of the poorest boroughs in London, is in Jamie Foxx's mansion, you know, seeing all the awards, Oscars and Emmys. And I'm just like, oh, wow. Life is good. In that moment, I'm like, life is good. I'm enjoying this. And then just to wrap up the story, we leave the party for a bit. And then Jamie Foxx has got me, Daniel, Samson Keo, and Damson Idris. And he's just talking about just how to move and maneuver in Hollywood and how hard it is. Back to your question to me, how hard it is for him at his level, you know, to get the work, to deal with the producers. And it was a real, like, young'uns, let me school you. Like, it's tough. And here's some tips to navigate it. And you might be going through something now, but trust me, you're not alone. And yeah, I never slept that day. I went home in my Prius and
just really quickly, because we're coming to the end of our conversation. Okay, how do you, in that situation, go, I want to have a photo with you, with Jamie Foxx, but like, you can't do that. Like, you can't, like, you're part of the firm now. Like, you can't fanboy this.
You can't. I struggle with it all the time because I am a fanboy, even though I'm working with my peers, you know, I say that from a humble point, but the young kid in me still wants to capture the moment. So I do a video instead. So I've got a video. When I see you, I've got a video and we're all just dancing and singing.
Okay.
And then I think, like you said, it's a right great moment for me. I'm doing Bel Air season 3, Tower season 3. So when I'm doing the press run, I'm going to events. It's there the moments that, you know, the professional photographer would get the moment and I would just get my manager or my publicist to get it. And it's lovely in those moments because I'm also being seen, which brings it full circle to, I think, your first question. I think there is a part of me that the kid from Care wants to be seen, acknowledged and loved. And in these moments, it's not that the work is always providing that for me, but it's a part of that, you know? And I've been working hard and I just think really happy to see Bel Air being one of the biggest shows in the US. And I'm really happy that Tower as well is being loved in the UK. And I'm getting to do two very different characters, do you know what I mean? And show like my range. And none of them are comedy, which is where I started. And so I'm really happy and I'm looking forward to maybe getting back on to doing some comedy for TV and on film.
Now, listen, Jimmy, you're a headline act, right, on Headliners, my podcast, right? You're a headline. And just like any headliner, whether it's a DJ, whether it's a band, the audience want more. So I'm going to give you some quick questions. This is the encore.
Okay.
One more tune, ooh, as they scream to the DJ, and you're the guy on stage. So I'm going to give you some quick questions.
Okay.
And let's see where you're at. So, Jimmy Akinbola, what was the last piece of music that made you cry?
The last piece of music that made me cry was My Brother's Keeper, which is a song my brother Shola Akinbola has written and performed that is coming out in his new album called How Should I? It's about my brother Shegan Akinbola. Yeah, it's about our brother that's not here anymore.
Yeah, I can understand why that would be very, very emotional for you.
Yeah.
What Instagram reels do you regularly share with friends and family? Is there a pattern to what you send out to your people on Instagram reels?
I don't filter my groups, so whatever I share, I share. So directly to my family and close friends, I share a lot of funny cat videos where they got American voiceovers, you know, and between me and my brother, a lot of football stuff. To everybody else, if it's a reel, I normally like to share sort of inspirational videos or some silly Bel Air BTS videos.
Love that. What genre of music, Jimmy, do you dance most wildly to?
Oh, most wildly to? It's got to be drum and bass jungle. You know, like if Apache, UK Apache comes on. That
original
tune,
Nutter.
Original Nutter. People are like, who is this guy?
Oh, love wow. You're tune. Going in. You're going in. You and Kush Jumbo. Do you know that Kush Jumbo, that's exactly the answer she gave? Bass and jungle.
I love Kush.
Right. So you two, I'm going to have to try and get both of you to come to Warehouse Project in Manchester when Andy C's playing.
Yes.
You can come and rave to that.
Oh, yeah. I love that.
If trying to impress someone through food, what dish would you cook?
I think I would cook a Nigerian, I think it would be like egusi, this Nigerian stew with fish and some plantain, I think and some yam. And I would present it in like a high dining way, you know, so they would not feel overwhelmed in terms of what they need to do with it. And I would force them to eat it with their hands.
What are you a snob about, despite hating yourself for being a snob about it?
I'm a snob about reality TV.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, like, you know, from the Big Brothers to Traitors to
you're not feeling it.
Love Island. I'm not feeling it. But if you put it on for 10 minutes, then I'd be like, why is she doing that? And I get in. But I really am a snob about reality TV.
What was the worst trouble you got into at school?
Ridiculously, I took my brother's nunchuckers to school. And they were, you know, it was legal, you know, because I was into martial arts and I was able to do it. And then it dropped out of my bag and I got suspended.
Oh, you actually got suspended for how long?
For about a week or two. And then I did it again with another instrument, but I won't share that on it. That's one for us. My older brother just was very good at martial arts and he had all the stuff. So I'd be like, let me go and impress my friends.
Wow, and you got suspended for it. Okay. Did you ever have an unwanted nickname? I mean, with a surname like Akinbola, was there too many kids ready to try and take the mickey out of that?
I had an unwanted song to my name. It would go like this, Jimmy Akinbola, drinking Coca-Cola. I'd be like, that's so lame. I used to hate that. But then as I got older, my nickname, people still use it now, was Mr. Nice. And like, there's the book, Mr. Nice. I'm not into drugs, but it was a book. But the play on that was that certain girls I would like, they'd be like, ah, you're really nice. You're like a brother. Like older people go, oh, he's such a nice kid. And then when I started doing events and, you know, network party nights, my business partners were Mr. Wolf, Mr. E, and I was Mr. Nice. And in some ways that stayed with me, but I want to let it go because it sort of doesn't allow you sometimes to speak your truth. Where it's like, I don't want to be nice right now.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So.
Wow. And this is often a difficult question with actors because they don't do normal kind of degrees in that sense. But did you do a dissertation? And if so, what did you do your dissertation on? Did you have to write a 10,000-word essay on anything?
I didn't. I went to drama school. I went to the Academy of Live Recorded Arts. But I feel like each time I've sort of created a character, you know, I've had to do some form of dissertation to what is my backstory. And I think my version of that is I had to write a big letter to the Council of Newham because I couldn't afford to go to drama school and pay for it for myself. So I had to write on the application form. It was discretionary. They didn't have to give me the grant to pay for the fees. But I wrote like 3 or 4 pages of like, I'm working 3-4 days a week at Stratford East. I just need my fees paid. I've got a council flat. I'm managing to pay my rent. Just help me pay my fees because I'm probably one of 2 people in the borough of Newham that's got into a prestigious drama school. And that dissertation got me money to pay for my drama school. And I wouldn't be here without that.
Jimmy Akinbola, that is a fantastic encore.
Thank you so much. Lovely to see you, man.
Lovely to see you.
Thank you so much, man. Appreciate it. We went deep. Take care, man.
Yeah, man. We went in.
Hey.
London. London to LA. Jimmy Akinbola. You know, it's really interesting when you've known someone for a long time and you've seen them go through, as many actors do. In fact, all actors do pretty much. That struggle to get where they need to get to, the jobs that they do, the hustle that they're on, the different routes that they go down. And then they get that break. And for Jimmy Akinbola, of course, that was all about season 1, Bel-Air, the remaking of Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and him being cast as Jeffrey, a completely different Jeffrey to the Will Smith Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And how he then moves to LA and then all of these things happen. And you know that these things are happening to someone who's worked so hard. And that feels good. It feels really good to see people like the actor Jimmy Akinbola do what he is doing. Coming up, Candice Brathwaite. Hundreds of thousands of Instagram followers. Inspirational, not just to women of colour, talking about parenthood and all the myriad aspects of life that we often find so difficult to understand. But she's also someone who's an ultra runner. She's someone who lights up a room with her intellect. She's someone whose thoughts people will hang upon and process themselves. If you've heard of Candice Brathwaite or not,
you will enjoy this conversation. And I don't mean that in a menacing way.
Live. With the BBC News on 5 Live at 9 o'clock, I'm Richard Foster. A row about donations has overshadowed the start of the Labour Party conference in Liverpool. The Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, has defended gifts given to her and Sir Keir Starmer from the Labour donor Lord Alley. But John McDonnell, the Shadow Chancellor under Jeremy Corbyn, says it's damaging the party.
I'm really pleased that Keir now has come out and said that's the end of accepting these things. But it has damaged us, undoubtedly. And the timing of the story coming out just after the cut in the winter fuel allowance has just exploded anger amongst people in my constituency.
A murder investigation has started after a man in his 60s died following a suspected assault in North Tyneside. Police were called just before 5 o'clock this morning in the Wall's End area. The victim died a short time later. Two men have been arrested and are in police custody. Lebanon says three people have been killed in attacks between Israel and Hezbollah. In northern Israel, thousands of people tried to shelter from rockets, cruise missiles and drones launched from Lebanon and Iraq. Our correspondent Daniel De Simone is in Jerusalem.
The deputy leader of Hezbollah has been saying there's a new phase and this is now an open confrontation with Israel. Israel is saying it's going to achieve its war goal, which is to allow 60,000 odd Israelis who've been displaced in the north due to rocket fire from Hezbollah. They're saying they're going to get those people home and they're saying they're going to continue their military actions until that's achieved.
A man has been arrested after police were met with what they called a hostile crowd of nearly 500 people at a car meet in Hampshire. Some of them are reported to have thrown stones at officers. The event started in Winchester and then ended in Southsea shortly after midnight. Germany's chancellor appears to have narrowly dodged humiliation after exit polls suggested his party held off the far right in his home state. Olaf Scholz's centre-left Social Democratic Party won Sunday's regional election in Brandenburg by just 1 or 2 percentage points. And the BBC's former economics editor Peter Jay has died at the age of 87. During his career, he was also an economics editor at The Times, a presenter of ITV's Weekend World, a British ambassador to Washington, and the launch chairman of TVAM. That's the news. Andy Barwell has the sport.
In the battle between two great Premier League title rivals, John Stones scored Manchester City's equaliser in